Show your support for KBOO today by becoming a member. Just text KBOO to the phone number 44321 and join the thousands of members who make volunteer-powered radio possible.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available on our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closures of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Program Advisory Committee meets on the second Tuesday of the month at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
Good evening and welcome to Labor Radio of the working class, by the working class, for the working class. I'm your host, Stephen Siegel, here with co-host Rachel Haynes. Hey, Rachel.
Hey, Stephen.
We are broadcasting around the world from Portland, Oregon. Both of us are public school teachers, and we host every second Monday of the month, where we typically interview educators and talk about what's going on in their schools and in their unions. And joining us today on the Zoom meeting is Catherine Watkins. Hi, Catherine. Welcome.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, we're so glad you're here. So we always like to start by just getting a little info about your teaching background and experience and what inspired you. So tell us about your background and experience as a teacher.
So I've been teaching for 23 years. Originally, I was just a high school English teacher for 21 years. I taught in Yuma, Arizona for 3 years, and then I moved up to Oregon, and I did 3 years in Scappoose, which was a racial nightmare. And then I've been in Beaverton District for the last 16, 17 years. And so this is my second year teaching middle school humanities for 8th grade.
Great. And tell us, what inspired you to become a teacher?
Well, I come from some pretty intense childhood trauma. And so coming to school was such a treat, such a retreat. And so I just loved it. There was actual food there where I didn't have food at home. There was safety when I didn't have safety at home. And it was just a pause from the chaos. And so my first time going into kindergarten, I was just like, I want to do this for the rest of my life. And that just led me through it all. And so the thing is, though, being a poor child and a child of color, also an undiagnosed dyslexic, I was not treated the way that I should have been to be supported throughout the school years. And so I was put into a lot of dumping ground school classes, just pretty much deemed stupid, and then eventually tracked into the she's not going to college. And so, but I still, in my mind, I was going to be a teacher. And so, by the time I was a senior, everybody's getting these college acceptance letters, and I go to my counselor and I'm like, okay, what am I having to do for the next step? I want to become a teacher. And she had the most, you know, like, oh, you poor little thing look on her face. And she said that she was just happy that I was going to graduate, and that I should consider going into cosmetology school or something like that. Now, if she was really looking at me, she'd know that I'm not a good candidate for cosmetology, especially back then. I was not some femme fatale. And so I was just crushed. And I was like, but I've wanted to be a teacher all my life. And when I had read Lord of the Flies in my 11th grade year, and I realized that it wasn't just a story about boys losing their minds on an island, but that it was a whole biblical retelling. It had all these different layers. And I started realizing how complex literature is. I realized that's the kind of teacher I wanted to be. Before that class, I was just going to do elementary because, you know, I'd always babysit and stuff. So I never really thought about you know, exactly what I was going to teach until my 11th grade year. And I was like, okay, I'm going to be a high school teacher because all my friends are wanting to know, how do I see Simon as this figure? And how do I see this? And I loved that. And I was only in 11th grade. So sitting in my counselor's office, she's like, yeah, we're just happy you're graduating. You got a 2.1. You're not going anywhere. And I was so mortified. And she had even asked me, you know, what does your mother do? My mother was a single mother who was a UC Berkeley student getting her doctorate with Indigenous literature. So then she kind of looked at me and she was like, wow, you know, usually children who come from college educated children are more successful in school. Again, I did not know that I had dyslexia. I just thought I was dumb, right? So I didn't understand how to explain to her that while my English teacher said I had the critical thinking skills, I just couldn't write myself out of a wet paper bag. You know, all these little clues to try to help me, and nobody was taking it. So my heart was crushed, and I went home to my mother, and my mom was just like, go to community college. Like, what's the big deal? And I'm like, wait a minute, what? There's a way out. So I learned I didn't have to do the SAT because I knew I was going to fail it. I didn't have to do the ACT, knew I was going to fail it. I moved so much, like 13 times throughout my childhood. So I did not have consistent education to do these tests. And then I have dyslexia. And so my mother just bypassed all of that. I went into community college and I found amazing teachers that were like, here's the errors. Could you fix them and bring them back to me? And some teachers would do this over and over and over so that I left community college with a 3.8. It was the most learning I had ever had in my life because all of these teachers were ready to educate me. Yeah. And so it got me to think, okay, I need to maybe become a college teacher, but I still wanted to do Lord of the Flies. So I went into eventually going into University of Idaho, following my education through that, and always had the idea of college. And now that all this stuff is going on, I have my second master's in writing, so that college is definitely looking like it's on the horizon.
Wow. Okay. There's a story right there.
Yeah.
and what about now as a teacher? You've been teaching for a while. What do you enjoy most about it?
I just love, I mean, still to this day, it's my most favorite thing, is that when you tell children that totally think that that everything is, you know, perfect, you know, and then you're like, can you just take a look at it at a different way? If you were this kind of person, if you were this, you know, just trying to help them find different perspectives. And then when they start seeing it, and then those questions that start coming out, does this mean that because of this, this happens? You know, I love that. And then when they start answering each other rather than me having to be the direct, I love to facilitate those deep conversations and to create a safe place so that they can have those conversations and hear different perspectives. It's beautiful.
Great.
Wow. So great to hear your path to teaching. It's really cool. Well, you've been through an intense couple of weeks and we invited you on to talk about it. You're an anti-bias, anti-racist teacher and have been part of a team of educators providing equity training for the staff in your district. And your group did a training back in February. Everything seemed fine, as far as you were aware, until a few weeks ago. So can you tell us what happened and how you were made aware of the problem, that there was a problem, and what you were told?
Yeah, bear with me a little bit. I'm still in trauma mode where not everything is solidly in my mind of what happened. And I'm still finding things out left and right, and that disorients me a little bit more. So I'll try to be cohesive about it. But we have this amazing group of teachers in our district, and they're called BMEC, so the Beaverton Multi-Ethnic Educator Committee. And so it's a group of BIPOC teachers and a few white anti-racist teachers who are wanting to do the work and to amplify our voices. And so with the response of George Floyd, we were really wanting to be active. We couldn't just sit and wait for the district to do something. And so we started upping our meetings and trying to find ways that we can start educating our district so that we can really start making those differences in the classroom. So you just had this inspirational group of people saying, I could do a session on this. I could do a session on this. We were meeting weekly with agendas and trying to figure this out. And again, these are all classroom teachers. You know, this is like their outside time. They're not getting paid for this stuff. If there is any kind of payment, it's very minimal. And so we eventually get this amazing menu of options for the teachers to choose from. And these are like things that our district has never presented to us. It was an energy that our district has never presented. And so we BIPOC teachers were so excited. And then the other teachers are getting excited to like all the different options and then getting upset because there's so many good options and they couldn't choose all of them. And so we were trying to find a way of like, okay, maybe we have to do this again and present these again so that those who missed one option would be able to do the others. And so it was really starting to form itself into like real anti-racist professional development, but teacher grown, you know. And I got to see a lot of teachers just growing into these positions of leadership, and it, because I've been here for 16 years, so I've seen some of these teachers that have just, you know, been their the classroom teachers, and now they're like, nope, I'm going to be a leader. And so we finally had it. It was so good. We're just grinning for days upon days. Towards the end of the summit, there was a fishbowl. And so there were 13 of us who were going to have a conversation about being teachers of color, but then also teachers in Beaverton doing anti-racist work. And how do you switch the culture around so that we are matching our ethnic student body? And so things were said, and everybody that was there. But for some reason, just me and Stephanie were focused on when it came to Parents Defending Oregon and Fox News. And so when our district was asked for a statement, rather than going, we'll get back to you, or, you know, what is your organization? There was just a response. And that response distanced themselves from me and Stephanie specifically, and then really disappointed the rest of the fishbowl people, because we were doing a service to the district of letting them know, you know, unfiltered thoughts of how it is to be a teacher of color in the district, how we feel when we see our teachers, our students of color struggling, and we're trying to be all that we can for them, but we are stretched so thin because there's not a lot of us in the district. Mm-hmm. And so really amazing information. People are sending messages going, oh my gosh, I've never heard this stuff before. Thank you so much. The support from our colleagues was so beautiful and inspiring. And so we were like, oh my gosh, we're rolling. We actually felt momentum, you know, for the first time in years. So, you know, we had the right words from the district saying that, you know, we support Black Lives Matter and we're an anti-racist district, and we, you know, we're all together. And then when the cards came on the table, it just didn't match up. And so the district was contacted, and we were not notified that people were investigating us. We were not told anything by the superintendent, the district deputy, the director of equity and inclusion. At one point, there was a principal that was starting to harass a white anti-racist teacher for using words like white supremacy. They wanted a nice fuzzy word. Mm-hmm. And she's on the equity team, so she's like, we have to use the words white supremacy. So she's getting bullied by this. And so I contact the equity director to say, you know, we need the support, because especially now that we have teachers who are inspired to step up and speak up, we have to make sure that we're protecting them so that they don't fall back to being quiet and hoping some a resolution comes. So when I called the equity director, I told them, And at the end of the conversation, I got the, oh, by the way, just want you to know that there is a group by the name of Parents Defending Oregon that has been asking about you. And I'm like, what? Oh, gosh. Okay. This was an after hours conversation. This was a by the way. And so I didn't take it to the magnitude I would if the superintendent and the equity director and the deputy sheriff or whoever he is, if they had sent me an email at work saying, be on the lookout, you know. And so this stuff is just milling around. I'm working, I'm walking around like nothing is going on, not knowing that slowly stuff is being put on the internet with my name, with my face. And so it's not until Thursday that it broke. So I can't remember the day, but it was like a week and a half ago. I'm at school. It's our first week back to hybrid. And I am about to end my lunch when I get a text from the equity director who says, are you in a position to hear something? I'm never in a position to hear anything. I'm working. So eventually he lets me know that the story just broke. And I play it. I am trembling. A good friend of mine who works in the building, she had texted me about something. I'm like, could you please come here right now? And she was there in a second. And so I was just like vibrating because I'm like, oh my gosh, now I got to go on Zoom. And I'm in the middle of teaching slavery, and that leads up to Reconstruction. So I am definitely going to be on display with this. And so I just did not know how to function after that, because especially I started thinking about, why did no one tell me? And then I started getting, you know, the feeling of like, where am I working? Can I trust? I thought that there was an understanding of how racism works. And so like, I'm just kind of like spiraling as I'm trying to be a teacher in front of my students. And so that led to eventually me just having to realize I can't, I every time I thought about trying to teach without protection, it just sent me into anxiety attacks. And so I waited to hear from the district. Nothing was really going on. I'm asking, why was I never notified? What are the protocols? What are they going to do? What's offered for me? All I'm getting is, let us know how we can support you, Catherine. And I'm not being told or shared the hate emails that are coming through. So I don't even know the extreme of the danger that has been visited on the admin side. I'm starting to get little Facebook things from people that are like in Florida and the Netherlands who have an opinion about me. But I don't know of what my district is receiving about me, because they're not sharing that with me, nor again is the officer contacting me. Mm-hmm. So I felt like if I was to return to school and all this stuff is bubbling up, I'm a walking target with children. And so, you know, bullets aren't accurate. And so I couldn't in good faith feel like I can go to work and be safe for myself, but then also keep my children safe when nothing had been laid upon as, here's the action plan. We know that racism happens. So we've, you know, studied this and we've created this and we're doing this. It's almost as if this is the first experience that's ever happened and they're just kind of waiting to see, how are we going to figure it out? It is reckless and dangerous and very, very hurtful. Because how do you talk to the people you work with who want you to trust them when there's no trust provided for quite a long time? And this is not my first racial problem here at this district. There's mm-hmm. quite a lot. Yeah. So that's kind of that in the nutshell.
I'm so sorry, Catherine. Yeah. Well, if you're just joining us, you're listening to KBOO Portland. This is Labor Radio. And I also want to remind our listeners that you can donate today at kboo.fm/give, or you can also mail an actual check to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, Oregon, 97214. So you've talked some about your district and how they initially responded. Can you say a little bit more about what's happened since in terms of more communications or meetings that you've had? I know it's hard to keep track of it all, but what's been happening sort of more recently?
Well, outside of the district office and, you know, admin positions, my coworkers from all buildings in the district have been phenomenal. I've never seen such unity since I've worked here. About 170 emails, messages, all supporting, all thanking me for saying the truth, you know, and risking stuff. And so I've never felt more connected to my district than right now, even though it's a horrible situation for that to happen. But I've had offers where if I didn't feel safe at my home, that I could go to them. I've had people sending me money so that I can go to a hotel. People have sent me meals, and even though I haven't really been feeling like eating, but my family is here and I still have to provide for them. And so people have just stepped up to be such amazing community. And so that has been my saving grace. I didn't receive an email from the district deputy until about a week later, a solid week. And that was only because some principals were complaining about it and pretty much demanding. And so he sent a pretty unsympathetic email about he's here and that there are things available if I need it kind of thing. My principal, Dr. Shannon Anderson, has been phenomenal. I have never had an amazing, supportive admin like this. Coming from Aloha High School, that was an absolute nightmare every single time racism happens. But this principal, Dr. Shannon Anderson, I want her to teach admin how to be supportive. She was just, it's almost like she just naturally empathetic, you know, but the emails, the phone calls, the texts, the I've got it, the I don't worry about it, just the sense of care and protection has really been a saving grace for me to not feel totally isolated and doomed. So, and then of course our union, and so we did immediately get my UNISERF, which is Leslie Munoz, and she is amazing, and she's helped calm me down a lot and make me feel a lot more secure. And so I've met with her and a few other from the fishbowl so that she can kind of get a perspective. And then we eventually have spoken with some other people so that we can kind of get an idea of the damage that has been done and how can we move forward from this. And then eventually it came down to I thought I was okay to meet with the superintendent. And so I agreed to meet with him on Wednesday. And I was supposed to go back to work on Thursday. And so my idea was that, you know, we'd meet, we'd have like this restorative justice kind of thing so that we can be all on the same page and then I can calmly get back into the classroom. Superintendent was there, the equity director was there, HR was there, Leslie was there. And I had about 10 questions that were kind of in my head, which were all restorative based, like, you know, what's the harm, who did what and stuff like that. And then the last question was like, how do we go on from there? And so I thought it wouldn't be fair to just go to the meeting and present those questions. So even though it was in the middle of the night, I sent it to the superintendent so that he would know that, you know, this is going to be a real conversation. This is not check-witty. This is not to say, yes, we did this. This is like, we really do see a problem and we want to move on and improve things. And so once the meeting started, was pretty much told, you know, like it's on me to present, you know, how do I feel? What do I need? So go ahead, Catherine, you're on. And I went back to, I thought this was going to be a restorative justice. I sent questions. I was hoping we can, you know, kind of see what pages we're on. And I was told that he just wanted to go to the last question and to focus on where do we go from here on out. So I tried to explain the whole restorative justice thing of like, we really can't do that last step without the whole process. And as we're trying to model anti-racist education, this is such an opportunity for us to provide models to help other schools so that nobody has to go through this again. But that wasn't what happened. And so I was told that we weren't going to do a blame or shame, and that the meeting was to find out what I needed. And so I could get 3 days or 3 sessions of therapy, and then I can use up my sick days. And that was pretty much what I was given. So no menu of options that the deputy sheriff has already thought about, or any protocols that have already been, nothing. I don't, you know, and again, I try to tell them, I'm just a classroom teacher. I'm just trying to survive. I don't believe in paternalism, so I don't want anyone to just swoop in and save me. But if you're from a resource, you can at least give me a menu of resources so that I know what could possibly work to keep my son safe, myself safe, my children, my students safe. And so it was very disappointing. And it was very much a statement of words are definitely just words.
So I know we're very short on time, but you know, we know that this is not an isolated incident. And so I guess if you could just, I know this is like a huge question, but what lessons have you learned that might be helpful to other anti-racist educators who come in under attack? And what work needs to be done to create systems that protect teachers that do this work?
Oh, okay. That's a good question. It is imperative that you don't think you can be strong and do this all by yourself. This is community work, and you've got to let your community help you. I've had to surrender a lot of ego of, you know, I can do this all by myself. No, I can't. This is too huge. It's too scary. I can't think straight. People have perspectives outside of mine. So really, when people come to you, embrace them, put them in a list if you need to, keep them in the loop of what's going on. Because they will also be able to say, you know what, that's not right, or I've got someone who can help you, and you really get to utilize your system of support. And so I've been very, very just proud of the people that I know, and the people who have just shown up that I didn't know, but now I do know. And so using the people that you know is really important. Documenting everything is extremely important. There is just a lot of things that happen, and it's he said, she said. And when you're doing anti-racist work, you've got to just understand that you will not be believed the first time, the second time, the third time. And it might not even be until someone who is different from you speaks up and augments that voice. And so sometimes realizing that that's just what has to happen, of letting others speak for you when there's times where you're like, I can't or I won't speak. But to have people who are willing to listen to your direction. So when you say, no, seriously, I don't want anything done right now, or yes, do everything, people who are willing to respect your needs during that time is very, very important.
Yeah.